So this morning, you know, we had a chance to listen to the first set of speakers, you know, talk about the what's going on in their organization, the speed of technology, and the speed of how the business has kind of moved forward. Our last speaker talked a lot about kind of culture and the culture of an organization. I'm excited to kind of talk with these three people up here to talk about organizations that are a data-driven culture. And we're going to get into a little bit of that this morning. We actually had a really great conversation about 30 minutes ago. We actually covered everything, and you know, you missed some really good stuff, and we're going to try to get some of that stuff back up here. So what I'd like to kind of first start off with is, you know, let's get you guys to introduce yourselves. Alan, we'll start with you. Introduce yourself, you know, who you're with, and what you do and your role, and what direct-to-consumer kind of means to you and your organization.
Sounds good. Thanks, everyone, for having us. I feel like we should probably represent at least four of the characters of Pixar, Inside Out, and I think I'll choose fear as maybe as a starting point. My name is Alan Dwan. I'm with Hearst Corporation. We cover everything from local television stations, magazines, newspapers, and have investments in Vice, Awesomeness TV, ESPN, A&E Networks, BuzzFeed, and others.
My name is Braxton Woodham. I'm a CTO at Fandango. We're basically making a transition right now from being a utility-focused company, if you rewind about 2 years in the past, to a kind of a lifestyle brand for all things movies, entertainment. I Love Movies is our tagline, and we have Rotten Tomatoes, Movie Clips, Fandango, Fandango Now for home video, and a host of other properties, movies.com. So we have a kind of variety of properties that work, in some cases, really closely together, and in some cases, really loosely coupled, like in the case of Rotten Tomatoes. Prior to that, I've been doing my own startups, sold an analytics company in 2011 called Tap 11, interestingly, and then after that worked at a company, or founded a company called Sunbasket that's still growing today.
Hey, my name is Todd Holloway. I'm the director of content science and algorithms at Netflix. Content science is essentially Netflix's data science team here in LA. So we support the studio. We do things like predict what or how shows are going to perform on Netflix so that we can figure out whether we should buy them or make them and so on.
So each of your organizations have obviously seen a great deal of change in the last 3 to 5 years. Each of you have gone through a different style of transformation. So can you tell us a little bit about how your organization's view on direct-to-consumer and your interaction with the consumer have changed over the last several years?
Sure, I guess I'll start. We've had pretty radical change. We, at Fandango, probably around 2014, started looking at growing the company via acquisition in two directions. One dimension was expanding across the whole life cycle, starting with movie clips, trying to get involved with the very first touch point with consumers around trailers, which is, of course, the largest driver, I think, of people's interest in different entertainment properties. From there, we also went along and acquired a few other companies, including Flixer Rotten Tomatoes, and Fandango Now came through two other smaller acquisitions that were rebranded under that banner. The other dimension was is really international, so we've been focusing on Latin America with the acquisition of Ingresso. So all those kind of happened really in a short period of time, and unlike a Google that can acquire a company a month, it's just like a whale picking up plankton, you know. In our case, it was really similar-sized companies coming together. So culturally, it was interesting. It wasn't all bad, but it was definitely for a while fairly chaotic. We had you know .NET camps and open source camps on the developer side. We had groups that are focused more on the media aspect, and developers were more of a service agency. Other companies were more tech-centric, and developers kind of ruled. So most of this year has been about bringing those cultures together. And focusing on how to structure a portfolio. And we looked a lot at models like Betaworks, if you know that company. It's like a, you know, an incubator and a kind of an investment firm, kind of hybrid. And so they have a portfolio of companies all focused on the real-time web. And so we looked at that and said we could do the same thing with movies and say we have a portfolio. And some of the companies in there, in the portfolio, like Fandango, are larger businesses. And then other ones, like movie clips or smaller businesses earlier stage. And so that's kind of how we operate with it. And then a core service layer with data and other core services like identity management and so forth that service all of these companies.
Gotcha. Alan, as your organization's changed over the last couple of years, going from a physical group into a digital, how's that organizational change been for you?
Yeah, so I'd say we've probably had somewhat by choice and somewhat not by choice, we've had a pretty drastic change in terms of how we look at our business. So if you see a lot of our properties, so just some of our magazine titles range from Cosmopolitan to Esquire or Popular Mechanics and Good Housekeeping. These are brands that have communities and audiences that they've been able to reach through the print medium or to a certain degree some live events and so forth. But what we found is that it's fundamentally different in terms of the way that we need to engage with our audiences going forward, particularly on off-platform distribution in areas like Snapchat and Facebook and Instagram. And so we've actually had to structure teams that are entirely focused on creating content explicitly for those mediums. So when we've got our Cosmopolitan Snapchat channel, it's actually a dedicated group of people that are creating these short video segments, creating these vertical video animations and so forth, and rethinking about how to engage with audiences and delivering them, you know, the same style and the voice of Cosmopolitan, but entirely new content.
Gotcha. Now Todd, you would kind of characterize yourself as a supply side data science guy. Are there, is that how your organization's structured? Are there more of you kind of floating around throughout the different life cycles at Netflix?
Yeah, well, we have, we have three big verticals at Netflix. You can think of it as being mostly a vertically integrated company where we have the recommendation engine, the user interface side, which is essentially our distribution channel. And so we have data science supporting that. And we have a second vertical, which is marketing, and we have data science that supports that. And then the third is content down here, the studio side. And of course, we have data science supporting that. And we all coordinate closely, align closely, so that we can work to each other's advantage.
Gotcha. Now, a couple of you had used the word life cycle, in your descriptions there to talk about the life cycle of a piece of data throughout the course of doing your work. What how do you each of you look at the notion of a life cycle, and how does that kind of play itself into the discovery and the storytelling of data?
The life cycle. an advantage of being vertically integrated like this and increasingly making our own content is that we can use, we have access to all of the data at the side of the distribution side. And so we can ask questions like, what specific members of our user base are underserved? And then we can go out on the supply side and try to find or make content to serve those people. So there's a lot of synergies there.
Yeah, and then I think for us, one of the things that we've been using a lot of data for is really driving some of the content that we create in inputs from everything from Google Trending News to sources that we have to just what our audiences are engaging with us on. So it's a very different model almost more real-time determination of what type of content will resonate with audiences. And quite frankly, it's actually very different by channel. The stuff that we're creating, just as one example for Facebook Live, we're finding that there's some very specific real-time in the conversation moments that people need to, that people are resonating with. And just as we take some of the data about engagement, we're learning things like, you got to start with some of the content for whatever live event is, but save the meat of the content to like 8 to 10 minutes into the live video, because it actually takes time for people to come into the live content, reach to other audiences that they think might also be interested, and you actually get a little bit more of a peak of adoption when you hit that point in time. So it's also changing the nature of what we put into the content or the timing of the content based upon the data that we're seeing in terms of the audience.
Gotcha. Braxton?
We kind of, similar to what you're talking about, we do the real-time data feeds around all the social media channels that we try to focus on, but we also, and maybe you guys do this as well, we do kind of these concentric endless loops where we have, for instance, each product line has a monthly review of data. We have our CFO does a data review that's monthly that's kind of crosses those kind of that way. And then we have the real-time data coming in. So we basically have these different loops that kind of constantly happen. Some are daily, some are hourly, some are monthly, and they all kind of feed each other. So that's kind of how we drive all the data programs at our company.
I read an article recently about the bane of existence in the data science world is the need for more and more clean data, and then a lot of your time is spent cleansing data. How would you guys kind of react to that and agree to it, disagree to it, whatever?
Well, it's a huge pain point for me, for sure. We spend a lot of time with a lot of different systems. Some are because we also, I don't know about you guys, but we integrate with POS systems with exhibitors. Those go across VPN lines. In some cases, it's to a central hub. In some cases, to individual theaters in all over the country. And those will drop out, and so we'll have these data drops that happen occasionally, and we have to kind of fill in the blanks. We're trying to get better about, with financials, we can't do this, but with marketing data, we're trying to do like interpolation, the way your eye, you know, has that little spot where there's actually no data there, and it fills it in with interpolation. We try to do that with some of the more linear marketing data, and then obviously we have to go back and really grind away at the financial data.
And is it a constant cleansing basis? I mean, are you pulling it in and cleansing it as you go, or are you actually pushing it back out to the sources to try to get it cleaner from its origination point? Alan, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a mix for us, to be honest. I think everybody in this room is facing the same challenge of the diversity of data that you're collecting, the differences in sources. I mean, even people's definitions of videos, for example, like, you know, we had a debate over whether a Snapchat Discover counts as a video. Is that, it's an animated, it's a certain amount of time, does it count as a short video? So even definitionally, it's been hard, but then the inconsistency across the data set that we get from the partners, who's measuring that, that's where we spend a lot of time making sure that we get at least something that we feel comfortable that we can draw conclusions off of.
So you just said something interesting there, right? You talked about getting in a piece of data, having an argument and a discussion on how you're classifying it. I mean, that sounds like it's the type of conversation a large, mature, established organization would have. So I'm going to toss this one over to Todd. You guys are a little bit more on the cutting edge. I mean, do you guys get in, and even Braxton, you can jump in as well. Do you guys get into that type of a finite discussion on the classification of data?
First of all, Netflix just has an absolutely phenomenal data infrastructure. All of Netflix's data has been in AWS for a long time. And internally, we have everyone in the company has access to all of the data. So everyone on my team can go into a single data warehouse interface and access. There are no data silos off limits. No one has to request access to data. And so when you have a lot of eyes on like that, and you have a lot of talented eyes on the data, anything that's important and not clean is going to sort of get surfaced. And so then the main pain point is just when we go out and we get third-party data sets, either from vendors, from scrapes, from partner studios and so on. It's just making sure that when we bring them into Netflix, we invest appropriately in cleaning that data up. And so that might mean everything from manual work to, if it's an important enough data set, creating machine learning models to do the work in an automated fashion.
Gotcha. Braxton, any thoughts, sir?
Well, similar, we actually use Netflix as a big inspiration for us as far as having all of our data warehousing in Amazon as well. And so I was like, well, these guys do it, so they seem pretty smart. But we do a similar kind of approach where we have all of our data aggregation kind of pipes into a lake that anybody has access to. We're probably not as mature on the cleansing aspects. We're getting more mature about how we clean that data and how we communicate what's clean and what's kind of raw. But right now we've done a good job of aggregating, and we're starting to get more and more sophisticated with the way we leverage that.
Great. So we talked a little bit about the sources of data, and definitely you've got some examples of kind of the pull-based demands. How about, where does it exist in your organization where you have people just sitting around saying, Todd, you kind of mentioned the use of data scraping, going out there and just trying to find stuff to throw in and bring to the organization. How does that process work in your organization?
We don't have a lot of process, so that's part of Netflix's culture. Culture is very important to a company, and I think Netflix has in part been successful because it's been able to pivot as a business a couple times. And so how that actually breaks down at a lower level, there's just not a lot of process. So if there's data you need, you just empower to go out and get it. Obviously, you can consult with lawyers and such as appropriate, but we don't worry too much about budgets. You just justified on the business case. And that lack of process, and that, I shouldn't say lack of process, the freedom of responsibility that we give everyone, that's really at the core of that succeeding.
Part of the culture there. Alan, how about the culture within Hearst?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say we similarly try to encourage a pretty broad range of people to go out to find unique data sets that can add insights that'll help us, whether it be on the content creation side, figuring out the right marketing distribution, really understanding ways that even kind of we talked about earlier panels, we're talking about how talent would get involved. You know, how do we smartly integrate and enable the talent to actually have a better set of access to the data that we have and also understand how they engage with their audiences? So a lot of different collaborations of how you actually can tie the data together.
Great. Braxton?
Well, I think kind of along with the lines of what Todd said, we think culture is really critical. I've been trying to push a few things that really, in kind of to your point, obviate the process, which is one is everybody in our tech organization works with tech. Everybody codes, including me. Some get to do it daily, and they're the lucky ones. Some of us have to take coding sabbaticals every quarter to do it. But we kind of make sure that everybody in the organization does that. I think that's one of the challenges I've seen in the media industry and other tech orgs is that they get too far from the tech. You have too many layers of managers, managing managers, managing managers, and eventually it gets to somebody who actually works with the data. And then when you do that, what I find anyway is that people lose context for what they're doing, and that's what's really the real problem. Well, there's also just all the people not adding any value, just drawing salaries. But beyond the margin issues, there's just a lot of people that have no context for what they're doing. I even struggle with that with my own company, with everybody coding, but it's a lot more optimized that way. So we try to just get everybody to be close to the technology.
Right.
That applies to data science, but it applies to other aspects of the tech as well.
Now, Braxton, we spoke last week, and you had mentioned that you guys were experimenting with some different organizational designs to kind of, I think, cut through some of that. You want to share a little bit of kind of currently your current approach to how the organizations are structured and how the different teams are focused on different elements of this work?
Sure. You mean the data specifically?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. For data, I mean, in general, we try to focus on these little small squads, and that's pretty prevalent in tech these days. The Spotify manifesto, probably everybody's read, and a bunch of other things like that, and it's evolving, obviously. But still kind of around the idea of keeping the teams fairly small and focused. With respect to data in particular, what I guess we were discussing was that we have a set of kind of checks and balances, a lot like Congress and the Supreme Court on a much smaller scale. Where we basically have an data engineering team in my group. We also have a data science group within our CFO side. We also have a group in marketing and then also in content. And so it sounds like Netflix is a similar thing. We're a bunch of people kind of working with data, working on it, and they could do some self-service and some service to others and say, hey, we've extracted this data. It may be interesting to your product managers or the product manager maybe highlighting things for marketing. So we try to let people be, you know, empowered in kind of direct ways, but also influence other organizations that may have different OKRs or KPIs that different objectives they're focused on.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and for us, I'd say one of the big changes that we've done in the last few years is enable data across the company and with partner companies. So previously we had groups, like our car and driver and road and track teams would have really good, interesting data about people who were in market to buy cars. That was actually quite interesting for our newspapers group. And basically by allowing our groups to share access to that information, it allowed us to actually scale. Because that was the biggest problem for us, was getting enough scale of the data that we wanted to be able to make that interesting as a data set. And so especially when you're coming into a world where you're competing in many ways with a Facebook or a Google or a Verizon AOL, the more that we can actually open up the data about audiences and in particular things that are more differentiated, there's lots of conversations that we have with our sister organizations as well as those that traditionally people have thought we've competed with.
So sharing data, how was that discussion carried out at Hearst? I mean, we've all been through it. I've gone through it as well. It's seen as territorial. It's seen as, this domain versus that domain. How'd you break those barriers down?
Well, I think there's a couple things. A few of the groups, just even within the divisions, there used to be rivalries between brands within a division, and that was almost by edict was you had to share, and they actually organized the teams so that at least on the digital side, it's actually all rolling up into one group, and so that data is made available for all the editors on that team, and in fact that's the kind of model that we operate, where if there's content that is relevant for both Esquire and Cosmopolitan, that same piece of content will be distributed and used across all those mediums. And so the whole concept of the metric is about the success of the content irrespective of the distribution has been one of the key drivers for that. And then I think the other part is just kind of a certain level of trust that and understanding that if we don't do it, we're just going to get eaten.
Gotcha.
And that's something that we got to try to open up more.
So sharing the data, obviously big. Todd, you had mentioned it was a huge part of your culture, foundational element. Braxton, you guys have gone through a heavy acquisition strategy. I mean, how has that integration of data gone for you guys? How much time have you spent with it versus just freely democratizing and making that available to everybody?
Well, we definitely try to make it freely available, but it takes a lot of work, actually. Yeah. So it's been a huge focus of ours for the last year. Basically, building out a common data repository where all these different properties can feed in data. We have to obviously spend a lot of time on PII and PCI data to protect consumers. So that's the one area where we do have a lot of process. But we try to have that as a small team that's an overlay, and we try to put all of that data in a very tightly controlled environment that's very limited as far as how complex it is. And then all the other data, more like the metadata, we leave that, you know, that more freely available, and we're a lot looser and more aggressive and risky with that, for instance, cast and crew information, that sort of thing. So we built out this core service out of our San Francisco office that basically is this movie metadata, or entertainment, we call it EMS, Entertainment Metadata Service, and that whole group's mission is to pull data in from third parties, internally from our properties, everything that doesn't involve PII, you know, personal information or any financial information, pull all that together and make it available via APIs or for direct access to any other portfolio company that we have. So that's been a huge focus of ours over the last year.
Gotcha. Great. So all that talk of data, you know, all the granular stuff you just mentioned right there, and as an ex-studio guy myself, I got to look at you guys and say, you got every shred of data I ever wanted to have, you know, when I was out there at the studio. But I know that the grass is always greener, right? So there's data that you want, that you want to get access to, that's just inches away from your grasp. Well, I'm here to offer you three wishes, right? And Alan, we're going to start with you. Three wishes for data that's just out of your grasp that you're just trying to get your hands on. What would they be?
I'd love Facebook's data.
Okay.
But more broadly, it is something that people trust or have provided specified interests, specific behaviors, understanding what people are engaged with at scale. And I think that helps us inform how to make sure that we get the right message out, and understanding specifically by channel how that interaction works.
Gotcha.
I think for me, one of the ones we discussed just in the back hallway there was the television data. A lot of the new smart TVs, you opt in to share some of your viewing information centrally. So those guys now have, you know, like Shazam for video. They're basically getting all the information about what people are watching on their televisions. And then further, what's really hard, impossible to get, but who's in the living room watching at that time and tracing all that back so you can better target folks in the living room. I'd love to have that information.
Okay, Todd?
I'm going to ignore the just out of reach part. I feel like if it's just out of reach, we'll find a way. Sitting next to the Rotten Tomatoes guy, you know, I think ratings, I'd really like to know, you know, at a more nuanced level what people's experience with the title is beyond just a rating. Like, I'd really like to know what it would have meant to them in that moment and what that moment was for them. I'd like to know we've just expanded globally, and so eventually we will have a lot of user data globally, but obviously in countries where we're new, it'd be nice to have the data that the competitors that are already established have until we get it. I could go on. I could name 1,000 of these.
We can work on that last one because we're working on a vector-based algorithm using some of this NLP AI stuff that Google has to derive some of that sentiment vectors versus just positive, negative, getting into like was it a static kind of reaction to something, or just, yeah, I would see it again, you know, if pressed. But we've dealt with Rotten Tomatoes to date.
Great. Fantastic. So knowing that this is a, you know, obviously the focus of this discussion is direct-to-consumer, let's kind of steer it back to kind of the direct-to-consumer space. I'm going to throw a couple of words out there, different words that I've heard kind of thrown around in the direct-to-consumer space, and just how do you and your organization, you know, look and address these three words? And the three words would be serving the consumer, influencing the consumer, and then connecting the consumers and bringing them together. Alan, you want to start?
Well, actually, I'd probably start with just an example I mentioned earlier that is not my organization, but, you know, today we saw the announcement of Michael Moore talking about the Trump land and releasing that. That's just, it's a very different model for releasing content and how that, and expectations from audiences today. So at least based upon the, you know, my understanding of how our audiences engage on that, they're expecting content around the movie as well. They're expecting some live discussions, ideally with Michael Moore, but potentially other people that were in the content. And so it's a very different model to think about how you actually connect with that audience, given the expectation that this isn't a future date that you're planning out, but something that is a lot more real time. And how do you actually make sure that you've got the right relevant content so that as we're creating, you know, a live conversation or engaging with fan bases, or a big part of what we're doing is connecting through influencers. So who within our influencer community can share the message out there and have audiences that they themselves are reaching? Like, how can we be smarter about that? And that's the type of challenge that we're trying to solve.
Gotcha. Great.
If anything, I think we focus mainly on serving. We try specifically not to influence. We try to remove friction, of course, but we want to connect people to either the creators themselves and let them present their, you know, their work the way they want to present it, and we want to make sure that we facilitate that as opposed to you know, having any kind of impact or effect on that in any kind of way that might distort things. So we try to really enable the creators to communicate the way they want to communicate. And then we also try to enable both critics and audience members to have the influence that they can or should have over kind of the way things propagate. And that's something we you know, talk about all the time, is how do we enable those people in a healthy way. Obviously, you know, we dislike seeing green splats the same way the studios do. It's better for everybody in the industry if all the movies are great and more people go to movies. So we definitely try to stay neutral and provide a service to the industry as the extent that we can.
Yeah, serving and influencing, I'll just kind of lump those together. So because Netflix is a subscription business with no ads, it has alignment with customer interests, right? Our only purpose from the product side is to make something that people will want to consume more of, that they just want to experience joy with. And so, you know, obviously we can, as I said before, we can do things like look at areas of our user base that aren't getting enough content and ask ourselves, how do we, on the supply side, go out and get that content or make it and make it with absolutely the best, in the best possible way we can. On the influencing side, you know, we do things like dynamically change the interface to make people more engaged. So we, you know, we make lots of cover art for each title, and then we dynamically figure out, you know, which cover art would appeal to who. We do things like merchandising in the service, where we're showing essentially ads, but they're for our own titles. But it's all in the interest of basically connecting people to content that we're pretty sure they would like anyways. So it's aligned with them.
Gotcha. All right. So as we were kind of chatting earlier, a new kind of question popped out. I'm still kind of working through the right phrasing for it as well. But we, you know, several, I think Braxton and Todd, both of you guys came from the Bay Area. Alan, I think you were from down here as well, same as well. So there seems to be the kind of this merging of Silicon Valley and Hollywood right now. And how's that going for all of you guys? I mean, how are those two worlds kind of meshing together, so to speak?
I think, you know, there's two kinds of data science conferences you can go to. There's the kind where it's very hardcore and you go and they're talking about, you know, the latest in deep learning algorithms, and people are just, there's a level of sophistication there. And then you can go to the ones that are more enterprise focused, where you have like Outback Steakhouse talking about how, not to pick on them, but, you know, talking about how they're trying to move into the cloud and these initiatives to maybe try a little bit of machine learning. And so there's a wide gulf often there. And I feel like, you know, coming into Hollywood, in certain areas, Hollywood's incredibly sophisticated with technology, like in the filmmaking process itself with for example, rendering. But then I see on the data side where there are still places where people pick up the phone and call up a studio and manually enter data into spreadsheets, right? And so, you know, hopefully as a community, we can come together and accelerate that. And I think part of it will be working with all the talents up in the Bay Area and building on that.
Gotcha. So yeah, go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, and I was going to say, so Hearst, I think, just has been fortunate in that I don't know if folks in this room have been to the Hearst Castle, but it's actually located halfway between L.A. and San Francisco in a place called San Simeon. Beautiful space. I highly recommend going to visit. But it's one where I think Hearst as a company has always had a pretty robust presence or focus area in both communities. And I think the goal of just helping to share and bridge a lot of that gap has been around just physically getting people to both locations and swapping. So we've actually had lots of people that are spending time down here, done lots of work with startups in the LA area, like a Gravity that got bought by AOL, to our joint venture with Snapchat on launching a new brand called Sweet. I think the more that people are involved in, and I think there's a lot of technology that's being working on getting further into the video production process, and as that has increasingly become more prevalent, we've just connected people more closely.
Gotcha. Braxton?
Well, I have tremendous respect for a lot of the folks that I work with in the Bay Area, but I actually am probably more excited about working in LA. That's why I wanted to be down here as my center of gravity. I think that, and the reason why is there's more engineers here than there are up in the Bay Area. It's just a little bit more diffuse. There's been a lot of different industries here, and I think that it feels to me like there's a groundswell. I've got other friends that are founders that have had good exits of their companies in the Bay Area coming down to LA. And I think that, you know, there's a lot more excitement and growth going on here right now. Not because it can't happen in the Bay Area, but because it's already kind of matured there. So I think that, you know, to me, it's just the excitement is actually here right now, because that's where the growth is. There's definitely a lack of maturity in certain technical areas for sure, which is a challenge, but it's also fun for folks to come in here and help kind of drive a movement.
Gotcha. So speaking of excitement, Alan, what are you working on right now that's putting the spring in your step?
Ooh, and I think this is something we'll probably talk about more broadly, is just some of the AI and machine learning capabilities and some of the things that we're experimenting with, quite frankly. We're still in early days with regards to how to actually enable that, but finding basically insights through the data itself and having non-intuitive elements come up to us with regards to, we've been doing a lot of work around imagery in particular, around what imagery, not quite to the degree that Pixar has done in terms of the facial expressions, but what imagery leads to certain types of activities from an engagement level. So do we see people more engaged when they see certain types of expressions or certain types of products or certain types of outfits? That type of stuff has been actually quite interesting.
Great. Braxton?
I've been really excited about the zero UI stuff. We've been working with everybody from Facebook to Apple to Google, et cetera. So, you know, every major tech company now has their own, their own assistant or kind of personality they're developing. So this idea of voice through NLP to, I mean, broadly speaking, voice to NLP to AI to you know, into your APIs has just been fascinating, and seeing how that plays out. There's a lot of context that you get and don't get and that you need to operate in those environments. And so we're definitely focused a lot about moving off of our properties and kind of just into the atmosphere, you know, with our service. And that's been really interesting on both aesthetically on the UX side as well as technically.
Yeah, most excited. So Netflix has increasingly become a studio, right? And so we get to ask ourselves, you know, that you have this business 100 plus years old in terms of, you know, industry 100 plus years old in terms of filmmaking. How can we come in and use big data and machine learning and all these technologies that we have very deep competencies in at Netflix and just software building and technology and ask ourselves, where can we, you know, in all these different parts of filmmaking, where can we apply these technologies and help the people doing this do a better job than they could do if they were somewhere else. And that's just so much fun to work on.
Great. That's fantastic. Todd, Braxton, you had mentioned a little bit about working with external partners. So as a startup, you had certain things you were doing that were kind of advanced and cutting edge, but then working with some of your external partners, they were bringing other things to the table that you didn't necessarily have. So do you want to talk a little bit about, the benefits you found with some of your third-party partners?
Sure. So I guess there's a couple different facets there that on one side, working with larger technology companies, and so we've had, in some cases, I don't know how much I can elaborate on this, but in some cases, they'll do some development on our behalf at some of the major, which is shocking to me, but in a pleasant way. And we would learn from these guys. Virtual assistants. We have some of those companies have helped develop those products outside of Fandango, but using our APIs. So that's been really, really interesting to watch and learn from these guys that are so deep in those fields. And then on the AI side, we're also looking at a bunch of different startups because as this develops the capability, we don't have that as a core competency at Fandango, but there's definitely a strategic question that we haven't answered yet. I'm sure a lot of folks have not answered yet about how much you need to develop in-house versus leveraging the intelligence that's being developed by other companies. And the reason why that's important is because you're now going beyond just primitive business logic into more nuanced decision making. And so if you don't do anything in-house and rely on partners for all of it, then you're basically handing over the decision making to them. And so that's a complex kind of topic that we've been thinking a lot about, both internally and also working with partners at small scale with specific startups focusing on AI, as well as some of these bigger players.
Todd, external partners for you?
Yeah, obviously we partner with a lot of the studios in Hollywood. Less so on the technology side. We have a much more build versus buy culture, and that's served Netflix very well. On the data science side, I think machine learning is far more ubiquitous at Netflix than I've seen at any company. I think just about every engineering team in the company has some machine learning talent on it. So the partners, we do partner a little bit for data. We do partner a little bit. Obviously, we partner a lot on the production side, but that's about it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Alan?
Yeah, for us, we probably take quite a different approach in partnering, where we do actually quite a bit of technology partnerships, and that spans from us basically saying we're going to focus in a few core areas, like the examples that I described in terms of AI or some data analysis and so forth. That we'll build in-house. But we're constantly experimenting in new fields, and just to kind of put one that's further out, like messenger bots as an example. That's an area that we believe that we need to be in. We believe that there's certain markets, not in the coming year or two, but probably a little bit further out, that's going to be something that is going to help us scale and reach audiences in a bigger way. And so we'd rather start now, do some early testing, figure that out, and we do that with a partner and enable that. So we do quite a bit of certainly the early experimental stuff, but then even some of our core systems, just as long as it's not an area where we think we can differentiate, we tend to just focus in on those resources in those areas.
Great, fantastic. I can see that we're out of time here, so I'd like to thank all three of you today for coming up here and talking to us.
And also, thanks to Jerry. Thank you, Jerry, so much. Gentlemen, fantastic. Oh, yep. Give it up.